or back on the Lower East Side. If it was desperately important for the people who lived in East Tremont that their neighborhood be saved, it was also desperately important for the city of which that neighborhood was a part. For 100 years, East Tremont had been performing a vital function for New York as an urbanizing area, a place in which families from European farms or small villages could become accustomed to living in a city, where a common consciousness began to evolve. A man from County Cork learning that the families next door from County Mayo weren't really such a bad sort. A housewife from a Latvian shtetl learning that the woman she met at the market who came from the Kiev ghetto was someone she could talk with. A consciousness that translated itself into a feeling of belonging in the city, and, more quickly in the case of the Irish and Italians than the Jews, who were always arguing among themselves, into political organizations that gave them a share of power in the city. It had been a staging area, a place where newcomers who had lived previously in America only in slums, successful at last in their struggle to find a decent place to live, could regroup and begin to devote their energies to consolidating their small gains and giving their children the education that would enable them to move onward and upward, to better, more fashionable areas. In 1848, it was Rhineland farmers fleeing revolutionary chaos. During the 1870s, it was the Irish fleeing famine or the Lower East Side. Just after the turn of the century, with the more prosperous among the Irish moving on to Fordham or University Heights or Riverdale, it was the Italians, many of them just off the boat, who followed the new IRT subway to what was then the end of the line and seeped westward to fill up all of the Belmont area north of 182nd Street. Then it was the Jews, filling up the area between Belmont and Crotona Park. And East Tremont, with the exception of Belmont, which the Italians held for their own, had been an integrated urbanizing and staging area. All the Germans didn't move out when the Irish arrived. All the Irish didn't move out when the Jews arrived. In 1950, there may have been 44,000 Jews in the area south of Belmont, but there were also about 5,000 Irishmen and about 5,000 Germans and Slavs. There was ample proof in 1950 that East Tremont was serving just as efficiently as an urbanizing and staging area, an integrated urbanizing staging area, for the city's newest immigrants. In some other areas of the city, the approach of Negroes and Puerto Ricans, part of the great wave of dark-skinned immigrants who had begun flooding into the city just before World War II, a flood that had mounted every year since, had meant flight, but not in East Tremont. Morrisania, just on the other, south side of Crotona Park, had become a predominantly Negro slum about 1930, but the people of East Tremont had not fled. Since about 1940, the less desirable tenements in the shadow of the noisy L along 3rd Avenue, right on the neighborhood's western edge, had been filled with Negroes, but the neighborhood had held. The same spur that had roweled the Jews into East Tremont, the hope of a better life for their children, had roweled Negroes there, right into the neighborhood itself. The first was Charles Smith, traffic manager for a fabric company, whose wife, a white Jewish girl who kept a strictly kosher home in Harlem, said to him in 1929, when their son turned 6, "Over my dead body, my son is going to the 135th Street School." Negroes in 30 or 31 who came up to the Bronx, they stopped at Prospect in Morrisania, Smith recalls. "We didn't want no Prospect. We came all the way up to Tremont." For a while, Smith's son was the only Negro child in PS 44, then in elementary school. But soon, more Negroes, doctors, lawyers, working men whose wives also worked to help make their families a better life, were following them into the neighborhood, some purchasing private homes, some moving into apartments. By 1933, there were 7 Negro families in Ellesmere Gardens, one of the neighborhood's best buildings. There were quite a few along Crotona Park North, the avenue facing the park that was considered East Tremont's most desirable location. But East Tremont took into its bosom the newcomers with black faces, as it had taken in newcomers with white faces. "People here were good with us," Smith says, and they were good with the pioneers who followed Smith. There were Negro women on the executive committee of neighborhood organizations. My daughter used to walk to school with two Negro boys, says Seal Cohen. We used to have Negro children over for dinner, and they used to have my daughter over. To tell the truth, we didn't think that way. You know, the way it is now, then. After the war, the influx of Negroes into East Tremont increased. An influx of Puerto Ricans began. But the influx stayed slow, and no whites left because of it. By 1950, there were approximately 11,000 non-whites in East Tremont, 18% of the neighborhood's 60,000 population. And the neighborhood was still holding just fine. Standing astride its whole southern border, Cretona Park provided East Tremont with a natural shield, a comfortably wide, and at that time heavily policed, dike against the decay flooding up from the south. Its brunt broken on the park's slopes, the decay oozed around its sides, searching for an opening into the clean streets beyond, but against it the park flung upward, at both its northern corners, extensions that were protecting arms. And there were social, perhaps even moral reasons, as well as physical, for the neighborhood to hold. The Jews of East Tremont, liberals, utopianists, socialists, fiery radical labor unionists, men and women who had held on to their ideals even under the lash and the knout, and the children of those men and women said they believed in the equality of men, including those with darker skins than they. One could argue about how deep that belief really ran, but in 1952, they certainly acted as if they meant it. The neighborhood was still the neighborhood. No one felt the need to move out of it just because a few more Negroes were moving in. But the strongest reasons were economic. Even if they had wanted to move out, the people of East Tremont couldn't afford to. In the 1970s, it would become a cliché to say that a neighborhood like East Tremont couldn't hold. But that cliché ignored the reality of rents that people could afford, and their inability to find such rents anywhere else. The influx of impoverished Negroes and Puerto Ricans might have been steadily increasing in 1952. The pressures on the neighborhood might have been growing stronger and stronger, but so were the economic realities that had kept it solid. Decent housing at affordable rents was becoming steadily scarcer. The income of East Tremont's older residents, now beginning to retire on inadequate pensions and Social Security, was falling. In 1951, with the non-white population of East Tremont already substantial and clearly going to increase further, the Association of Young Men's and Young Women's Hebrew Associations of New York, considering building a new Y to replace the Clinton Avenue building, had decided to determine whether or not the investment would be worthwhile and had conducted the most detailed survey of East Tremont residents ever made. Its conclusions were clear. Negroes might come, the Jews would stay. For more than 20 years, the pressure of urban decay and blight had been pressing on the neighborhood, but for 20 years, the neighborhood had held. Leave it alone, and it would continue to hold. By 1952, there were 775,516 Negroes and non-white Spanish-speaking people, a full 10% of New York's residents, in the city. And as the Irish had done a century before, and the Italians and Eastern European Jews half a century before, these immigrants from the South and from the Caribbean were continuing to pour into the city by the thousands and tens of thousands. For its own sake, as well as theirs, if the city was to prosper, or if it was even to endure as a place in which people, white or non-white, would want to live, it would have to offer the newcomers the same chance it had offered their forerunners, would have to absorb them by providing neighborhoods in which they could learn to cope with urban life, in which they could consolidate the gains that had enabled them to move out of the real slums in the first place and prepare for an assault on even better places to live, neighborhoods which would serve as urbanizing and staging areas. And it would have to provide urbanizing and staging areas that were integrated. If it did not, if these newcomers to New York were forced to live in ghettos, compounded with their resentment at their inability to provide a decent place for their children to live, would be an alienation from the society which had isolated them. These people, who were making up more and more of the city, would be an alienated, hostile, hating force within it. If the city was going to endure, neighborhoods like East Tremont were going to have to endure. And if it was left alone, this neighborhood would. The letters came on December 4, 1952. For years, East Tremont had been vaguely aware that one of Robert Moses' highways was going to run through the neighborhood, that part of it was already under construction over in the East Bronx somewhere. But there had been no hard facts available, and, as Mrs. Lillian Edelstein says, it had gone on so long, and you keep hearing and hearing, and nothing happens, and after a while it doesn't mean anything to you. When they thought about it, if they thought about it, they were sure it would run along the edge of Crotona Park. I mean, it was so obvious. You just figured it was going to go there, Mrs. Edelstein says. It was in the wind for a long time that he was going to come through the apartment houses, but we just didn't believe it. But on December 4th, a Tuesday, the letters were there, in hundreds of mailboxes, letters signed by Robert Moses, City Construction Coordinator, informing each recipient that the building in which he or she lived was in the right-of-way of the Cross Bronx Expressway, that it would be condemned by the city and torn down, and that they had 90 days to move. It was like the floor opened up underneath your feet, Mrs. Edelstein says. There was no warning. We just got it in the mail. Everybody on the street got it the same day. A notice. We had 90 days to get out. I remember it was a nice day, too, for that time of year. We all stood outside. Did you get the letter? Did you get the letter? And what does it mean? 3 months to get out. Some people had gone out early and hadn't heard. We told them. And then we all waited for our husbands to come home. And my husband said, "You can't do anything." The 90-day figure was meaningless, of course. At the time Moses sent out his letter, the money to build the East Tremont stretch of the expressway was nowhere in sight. Months, if not years, would be required to obtain it. The city had not even acquired title to the property yet, and there were months of procedures necessary before it could do so, and before demolition could begin. Privately, Moses was figuring not on 3 but 18 months to clear the area. The use of the 90-day figure was a scare tactic. To shake him up a little and get him moving, a Moses aide explains. The tactic accomplished its purpose. As the full implication of their position began to dawn on the tenants, they became very scared indeed. The first thing you do, naturally, you look to see what else is available, says Mrs. Roberts. My husband and I looked in the papers and asked around, and when we first found out the type of rents, says another East Tremont housewife, we had been thinking before, for years, about moving to Pelham Parkway. You know, not really seriously, but just talking about it from time to time. Pelham Parkway was a very, very nice area. But now we went over there. My God, on Pelham Parkway, they wanted $100 a room. Priced out of other decent neighborhoods, they turned to a task they knew before they started was almost hopeless, finding a new apartment in their own. The Y was inundated with requests for information about local vacancies. Occasionally we'd hear about one, says Y director Barney Lambert, but this was 1,500 families that needed them. A subsequent notice from Moses said that tenant relocation operations were already planned and promised that we shall cooperate in every possible way so as to avoid hardships and inconveniences. On the completed easterly Section 3 of the expressway, he stated, tenant relocation had proceeded in an orderly manner. This notice proclaimed that its purpose was reassurance. We are issuing this honest schedule for acquisition because most Americans prefer to be told just what is in store for them. They dislike uncertainty. Its result was panic, for East Tremont had formed a tenants committee, and, heading over to Section 3, it found out what orderly tenant relocation operations meant when carried out under the direction of Robert Moses. The expressway had been completed over part of Section 3. A great swath of concrete, 225 feet wide, grayish-white, unmarked by the treads of a single car, had been laid neatly to within about 2.5 miles of East Tremont. But those 2.5 miles were a scene of desolation and destruction such as the committee members had never seen. Some of the right-of-way had been cleared. Where once apartment buildings or private homes had stood were now hills of rubble, decorated with ripped-open bags of rotting garbage that had been flung atop them. Some of the right-of-way was being cleared. Giant wrecker's balls thudded into walls. Mammoth cranes snarled and grumbled over the ruins, picking out their insides. Huge bulldozers and earth-moving machines rumbled over the rubble. A small army of grime-covered demolition workers pounded and pried and shoveled. A thick layer of gritty soot made the air feel very dirty. I took out a handkerchief and wiped my forehead, and it came away black, absolutely black, Mrs. Edelstein says. Over the rumble of the bulldozers came the staccato, machine-gun-like banging of jackhammers and, occasionally, the dull concussion of an exploding dynamite charge. And in the midst of this landscape of destruction, a handful of apartment buildings still stood. From the outside, the East Tremont Committee saw that most of their windows were boarded up. Going inside, they found the lobbies littered with shards of broken glass that once had been big ornamental mirrors, and with the stuffings from the armchairs and sofas that had once been their decoration, and smeared with excrement, not only animal but human, from winos and junkies who slept in them at night. Stumbling upstairs, the committee found the doors to many apartments ajar. Through them, they could see empty rooms, walls ripped open by vandals who had torn the plumbing pipes out of them. Other doors, however, were closed and locked. On them, especially around the keyholes, were scratches and gouges that showed where someone had tried to break through them. And behind these doors, the committee found people, not winos, but respectable Irish or Jewish families like themselves. Some of the apartments were furnished, nicely, for the families living in them were the families who had always lived in them. In others, the families were living out of suitcases, and the only decorations were cheap curtains placed on the windows in the hope that proof that someone was living behind them would deter vandals from breaking them as they broke the windows of unoccupied apartments. And the horrified East Tremont housewives heard the housewives in these apartments inform them that they were living there only temporarily, that they had been moved into them by the city when their old homes were demolished, and that they expected to be moved out of them, into other temporary headquarters, when it came time for the city to demolish them. The expressway had pushed up to the very wall of one apartment building, concrete bellying right up to the brick. Going inside, the committee found one family, a middle-aged couple with two children, who had been moved into the building only a few weeks before, and who were obviously going to have to be moved out of it in another few weeks. Standing shivering in cold rooms, for in most of the remaining apartment buildings in Section 3 there was, of course, no heat, the committee from East Tremont heard women, respectable housewives like themselves, women who had always been proud of the homes they made for their families, state that they had been shunted ahead of the path of the expressway over and over again, forced to move like gypsies, one said, from one condemned building to another, each one further along the expressway's route, for years. Disbelieving, the committee heard the topper. These dispossessed families were forced to pay rent for their heatless hovels, and each time they were forced to move, they were hit with a 15% rent increase. Section 3 had received the same assurances that Moses was now making to Section 2, they said, back in 1946, when the city had taken title to that section. The city had even set up a tenant relocation bureau, supposedly to find them new, comparable living quarters. They were still living in Section 3 because the tenant relocation bureau, an agency closely allied with Moses, had not found them such quarters. The only apartments she had been shown were apartments not fit for rats, one bitter, middle-aged housewife said. And the rents asked for those apartments had been double what she had been paying for a nice two-bedroom apartment, double what she could afford. One elderly widow, one of three tenants left in a 20-family apartment house, had been ordered to put her furniture in storage and move into a single furnished room. She was desperately holding on to the apartment in the hope of something better because her son, an Air Force flyer in Korea, was expected home soon. When he had left her, he had had a home, she said. He has a right to expect a home when he gets back, too. The Post had inquired about tenant relocation in Section 3. Moses had replied, "None of the families living in the path of the Cross Bronx Expressway has been turned into the street. The city, through its real estate bureau, has treated every family involved in a considerate, humane manner." From the tenants still living in Section 3, and from families who had moved out, the East Tremont Committee heard about the Real Estate Bureau, another agency closely allied with Moses. When you first went to the office the Bureau had set up at 1 Hugh Grant Circle, the committee learned, you were told that you had better try to get an apartment yourself. As an inducement to do so, and thus save the Bureau any work at all, you were offered $200 per room, little more than enough to cover moving expenses. When you returned to the office and said you had been unable to find one that you were willing to live in and that you could afford, the Bureau's first reaction was to tell you there was nothing more it could do, implying it had washed its hands of your case entirely and leaving you with the feeling that there was no help available for you from anyone in the city government. If you persisted and insisted on being shown other apartments, you would be taken, eventually, to inspect, along with other people who had insisted, comparable apartments. Apartments that were indeed comparable, and you had to be one of a lucky few to be shown any of those anyway, bore rents 3 and 4 times those you were currently paying. And there were hardly any of those available anyway. Most of the apartments you were shown were ancient, filthy, cold, dark tenements and slum warrens. When, in desperation, driven to willingness to accept the stigma, you asked if the city, which was destroying your home, could not give you another one in one of its public housing projects, you were told that there were tens of thousands of people ahead of you on the waiting list. One resident of the condemned buildings in Section 3 said she had been on the list for 6 years. And what if you tried to hold out, to insist on the comparable apartment that the city had promised you? When the time came, the city's bureau had methods for discouraging you. It would set a deadline and inform you that the $200 per room they were offering for moving expenses would be reduced to $100 if you did not get out by that date. Then, if you still had not moved, they might set another deadline, on which the amount would be reduced to $50 or to nothing. Then there was the barrage of threatening notices and directives, designed to make you feel that you might return home one day to find your belongings out on the street. One, sent out in 1949, told the recipients that the city required their premises for the immediate purpose of demolishing. You will please take further notice that upon your failure to remove from the premises within the time specified, legal processes will be instituted to recover possession of the premises. When you protested, when you formed a committee to protest, yes, the DPs of Section 3 said they had formed committees, too, all protests were referred to Moses, and Moses would never even reply to them. Insisting did no good. After interviewing the tenants left in Section 3, Mrs. Edelstein reported that they knew of no one who was relocated by Mr. Moses. Some 325 tenants had moved out, been forced out of the area by his tactics. But when the committee from East Tremont arrived in 1952, 6 years after orderly tenant relocation operations had begun, there were still living in those doomed, half-empty hulks in the expressway's path no fewer than 250. It was no wonder that when Mrs. Edelstein reported the results of the committee's investigation at a neighborhood mass meeting, they were received as a nightmare. But East Tremont's panic was soon replaced by hope. The hope was based on faith in Robert Moses, or more accurately, in the Moses mystique. East Tremont's pious Jews still held the campaign of 1934 against him. "I hated him since the time he said he wasn't Jewish," one says, but they still believed in his image as a man above politics and bureaucrats. Believing in that image, the people of East Tremont were sure that if they could only present Moses with an alternate route through their neighborhood that was truly better than the route he had chosen, he would accept it, and it did not take them very long to find out that such a route was indeed available. Bronx Borough President James J. Lyons, Lyons' chief engineer, Moses' old planning commission ally Arthur V. Sheridan, and Sheridan's veteran aides had all been in on the laying out of the route Moses had chosen. But when the East Tremont Committee asked for an appointment with Lyons, Lyons aide Charles F. Rodriguez recalls, Lyons fobbed them off to Sheridan, and Sheridan fobbed them off to someone else. And the someone else happened to be a recent addition to the staff named Edward J. Flanagan, who was, Rodriguez admits, a capable engineer, but who had never, during a long engineering career, been associated with Moses, and who was very cocksure of himself, by which Rodriguez apparently means he was not afraid to say what he thought. And when the housewives mentioned the possibility of an alternate route, Flanagan, without letting them finish, said of course there was, took out a pen, said, there's no reason the route couldn't go this way, and sketched on a map before him the route through Crotona Park that was precisely what they had had in mind. Flanagan was silenced. No one from East Tremont ever got an appointment with him again, but he had given the housewives conviction that the alternate route was feasible. The Bronx County chapter of the New York State Society of Professional Engineers agreed to make a formal study of it. And one member of the society had enough experience with large-scale highway construction to do so, experience garnered working, indirectly, for Robert Moses. Bernard Weiner, a refugee with a heavy accent, was the brilliant engineer who, after working during the 1920s on the Westchester Parkway system, had gone to work for Madigan Highland and designed, among other Moses projects, all the concrete bridges on the Circumferential Parkway, although he could not pronounce circumferential, and the revolutionary three-span skew-frame interchange that carries the Whitestone Expressway and Grand Central Parkway across each other in Queens. Then his independent outlook, he kept insisting that if Moses did not increase the grades on the circumferential, it was going to flood in heavy rains, got him dropped from the team. Weiner, who had found it impossible, despite his experience and acknowledged brilliance, to get a good job since, had learned the price of opposing Moses, and he was not willing to pay it in full anymore, but he was willing to pay part of it. When the Bronx chapter asked him to do studies of the alternate route, he agreed, only on condition that I would be anonymous. Another engineer's name was signed to them, but he did do them with his usual thoroughness, drawing up not just a sketch, but a complete engineering study that demonstrated that the route through the park was not only feasible, but met every federal and state standard for expressway design. The arguments in favor of the park route were clear. By making only a gentle alteration in the road's route, swinging it just two blocks, one block in some places, to the south, 1,530 apartments would be saved at no cost to anyone. The road would not be made longer, its curves would not be made sharper, its efficiency as a traffic-moving device would not be harmed in the least. We were happy then, recalls Lillian Edelstein. We had been worried, but when we found out there was a feasible alternate route, we figured we were in business. The arguments in favor of the alternate route were so clear. Believing in the myth of Moses, the housewives of East Tremont were sure he would accept them. And it wasn't until they tried to present them to him that panic set in again. For neither he nor any of his aides would even listen to those arguments. There would be no point in any meeting, Moses' office told Mrs. Edelstein when she telephoned after letters and telegrams had gone unanswered. The coordinator had already decided on the route. It would not be changed. Even then, East Tremont felt it had recourse. I mean, we felt that Robert Moses might be powerful, but he wasn't the final say, was he? Says Mrs. Edelstein. Most of the money for the expressway was coming from the federal government. In some vague way they didn't understand, the state was involved too. They had elected officials in the city to represent their views. The Informal Tenants Committee had by now become a formal group, Aetna, the East Tremont Neighborhood Association, and Aetna had found a leader. Sam Edelstein's wife, Lillian, had never led anything. Ask her to describe herself, and she says, I was just a housewife. And that was what she was, at 39, a strikingly handsome one. But Lillian Edelstein had a big stake in the fight. Not only would she lose her apartment, which she loved and whose $56 rent she could afford even on the $75 per week Sam brought home from his job as a blocker of women's hats, if Moses' route was chosen, but her mother and her sister would lose their apartments too. They all lived at 867 East 176th Street, Lillian in 2F, her sister in 3F, her mother in 3G. It was important to Lillian Edelstein that she be close to her mother. Her father had died just a little more than a year before, leaving Anna Cohen, born in Russia and able to speak English only haltingly, alone. It was all right as long as her children were close by. But what if we were separated? What would Mom do? And it was wonderful that she could be close to her sister and to all the East Tremont girls with whom she had grown up. Her younger daughter Janet was only 5, but her older girl, Carol, was 15 and a junior at Roosevelt High School, and when she heard she might have to leave all her friends, she began to cry. "I was fighting for my home," Lillian Edelstein says, "and my mother and sister and daughter. I had a lot to fight for." In fighting, she displayed not only energy and determination, but an indefinable quality of command. Soon, Etna was turning to her for leadership, and she was providing it. She organized mass meetings and rallies and invited East Tremont's elected officials to them, and, refusing to be turned away by secretaries and assistants, secured appointments to talk to them in person. And their reaction was encouraging. East Tremont's congressman, Isidore Dollinger, pledged his support. East Tremont's legislators, State Senator Jacob H. Gilbert and Assemblyman Walter H. Gladwin, pledged theirs. Most encouraging of all was the reaction of the city officials who would play the most direct role, not only of East Tremont's councilman, Bertha Schwartz, but of higher-ups, men who to these housewives had been only names in the newspapers, names they associated with enormous power. When Etna's executive committee went down to City Hall for the first time, more than a little in awe of their surroundings, Comptroller Lazarus Joseph put them at their ease, told them that Moses' new highways are making a jigsaw out of the Bronx, and that their alternate route was certainly worthy of a full study, promised to vote against condemnation of their homes until such a study was made, and said that if the study showed the alternate route to be feasible, he would vote for it. Borough President Lyons received the delegation cordially and warmly, one member wrote. He promised that his engineering staff would make a formal study of the alternate route. The delegation left feeling that he was very much on their side. 2 weeks later, those feelings were seemingly confirmed. Lyons told the Post that his engineers had decided that the tenants' route was not only humane but feasible, that it would save the city money, and that he was in favor of it. Noting that Lyons had previously approved his route, Moses angrily charged that the borough president was raising objections now only because it was an election year and there was local opposition. Any local hardship will be mitigated, if not entirely removed, by the elaborate steps which we have taken to move tenants in an orderly way into public, quasi-public, and other housing, and should be disregarded anyway, he said. This route will be the backbone of traffic for centuries after a few objecting tenants have disappeared from the scene. You have from time to time remarked that I do not have to be elected to office. Perhaps that is why I am in a position to protect the really long-range public interest. He used his old threat. Only recently you lost a substantial amount of money in the Bronx by blocking the Bruckner Expressway. The Cross Bronx will cost more than $30 million additional. Would you like to see the project, now half completed, abandoned, and remaining state and federal monies spent elsewhere? And then escalated it by threatening to resign as construction coordinator. I should not care to carry this responsibility any further if borough politics are to be injected into it. But Lyons replied that any insinuation that he would allow himself to be influenced by the imminence of an election was a damnable lie. This is not Russia. Here we have democracy, and the people should be able to speak out in order to save their homes. Councilman Schwartz had told the tenants about the borough president's union, and they understood that if Lyons stood firm, Moses' route would not be approved. And so it was with a sense of victory in a righteous cause that on Thursday, April 23, 1953, more than 200 East Tremont housewives, East Tremont husbands could not afford to lose a day's pay by skipping work, traveled by chartered buses down to City Hall to hear the Board of Estimate decide whether to give Moses' draft damage maps the approval that would be the first step toward condemnation, and saw the board members file out of a door on the raised platform, and then saw, striding out among them, right behind Mayor Impellitteri, the legendary coordinator. "He came in and everybody hushed," says Lillian Roberts, "even the men around the Board of Estimate. He wielded power, you could see. A powerful man, and you could see it. Arrogant. The big I am. Me. Chest out. He came out of the private room and stood behind the mayor, and behind him were two of his men. And the way he talked to the mayor, he practically ordered him around. And when it came time for him to talk," Mrs. Roberts wrinkles up her face to indicate the disdain and scorn on Moses, "this is going through, and this is going through, and that's all there is to that. That's the way he talked." Says Barney Lambert, "he dominated. It was like he had inherited a crown. This sense of superiority was there." It took Lillian Edelstein only a few moments to start losing the hopes with which she had come to City Hall. "Handsome, tall, dark, a distinguished-looking man he is, but a mean face, a mean person. When you looked at him, you saw he was a sour person. He looked right at us, like we were little people. He made you feel you were little. And then he looked away, a horrible man. He was talking to each one of the borough presidents. He had Lyons first. He had each one of them separately. And the horrible thing was that they were all listening to him, whispering. No one was listening to us when we talked. When we were up there speaking, they talked among themselves or with their assistants. They're having a ball. You're talking and presenting your case, and they're laughing about something else. They didn't even have the courtesy to show an interest." She had pinned her hopes on her borough president and his promise. Therefore, Lyon's statement surprised her. He favored Moses' route, the borough president said. He had always favored it. Mrs. Edelstein was sitting beside Councilman Schwartz in the first row. "Everybody's poking me in the back and saying, 'Hey, Lil, what's going on here?' I said, 'I don't know.' I had reassured them. That was why they came down the way they did, because we had a possibility of winning. We had a meeting on Tuesday, and I said, 'Come down, he's with us. Show him we're behind him.' So I said to Bertha, I said, 'I think he's pulling a double cross, blast him.' She said, 'I can't, I'm a public official, but when you go up there, you blast him.'" She did. At the conclusion of her short, carefully prepared speech at the lectern at which speakers stood, the housewife looked up, pointed at Lyons, and said, "As for you, Mr. Lyons, I have this to say. You've double-crossed the people." What happened then? Flashbulbs, Impellitteri starts yelling, demanding that I apologize. I said, "I'm not apologizing." Jumping to his feet, red face redder than usual, Lyons bellowed that all he had promised the tenants was a right to their day in court. He had never, he said, given them any reason to believe he was on their side. Rudolph Hawley then disclosed that the board had held an executive session the day before, at which Moses had been present, and that at that session Lyons had attempted to have the board approve Moses' route secretly, so that the day in court would be meaningless. Whirling on the borough president, the liberal council president shouted, "Stop putting on a show!" "Demagogue!" Lyons shouted back. The uproar changed nothing, of course. Hawley and Joseph stuck by their promise to the tenants, and their six votes kept Moses from mustering the 12 necessary to approve the maps on initial submission. But at the board's next meeting, a simple majority of its 16 votes would suffice. 300 housewives showed up at that meeting, bringing a new nickname for Moses' route, Heartbreak Highway, and a copy of the Bronx Engineering Society's detailed map of the alternative. Impellitteri announced that the board's chief designer, Robert G. McCullough, would study the map. McCullough must have been a quick studier indeed. Within a few minutes, he announced that the alternate route was unfeasible. William Chapin pointed out to the board that great sections of the Bronx had already been torn up for other sections of the expressway and for other highways, which, the Moses man said, had been approved by federal and state governments on the premise that they were all part of a single system, of which the Cross Bronx Expressway, with the route drawn by Moses, was a vital part. If the board refused to approve the route, he said, Washington and Albany would refuse to put any more money into the expressway, or possibly into the other Bronx highways. State DPW Chief Ptolemy had already sent Moses a letter threatening to do just that. If there was no money, the highways would remain unbuilt, and somebody will have to put the Bronx back together. Hawley accused Chapin of trying, on Moses' behalf, to blackmail the board. Demagogue! Lyon shouted again. By a vote of 10-6, Moses' route was approved. It was a farce, Lillian Roberts says. It was like Mr. Moses runs the city. Understanding this, when the housewives of East Tremont fought now, it was with a sense of desperation. The poverty of their community made fighting all the harder. Years later, an acquaintance casually remarked to Lillian Edelstein that another group of housewives, Central Park West housewives, had, in a battle over expansion of the Tavern on the Green parking lot in 1956, won a victory over Robert Moses, and was startled to see the eyes of the tall, dignified woman filling with tears of remembered frustration. "Do you know why?" she said bitterly. "Because they had the money for an injunction, that's why." Mrs. Edelstein had been informed at the very beginning of her fight that there were ample grounds for a full-scale legal court battle, a battle which would, even if not successful in changing the expressway route, force the city to give tenants comparable new apartments. But, she was also informed, the legal fees could run to $10,000. Had a single one of the threatened tenants been a lawyer, with a personal interest in the case, legal help might have been available, free. But not one was. In the Bronx of Ed Flynn and Charlie Buckley, there were no political dividends and quite a few political disadvantages to be reaped from opposing a project that Ed Flynn and Charlie Buckley favored. Several young attorneys did come forward with offers of legal assistance, but invariably their interest waned quickly. $10,000? Lillian Edelstein had difficulty raising amounts far smaller than that. The feeling among people was, what's the use? Explains Arthur Katz. You can't lick City Hall, and even if you could, you certainly can't lick Robert Moses. We were told by the politicians we saw that when Robert Moses wanted his way, that was it. For a while at the start, with Lyons, when he promised, they had hope. But now... You'd think people would fight for their homes, says Saul Janowitz. But Mrs. Edelstein had to beg and plead to persuade families to chip in a dollar bill at a time, and each time the dollar bills were harder to come by. Nonetheless, a small band fought. Most of its members were businessmen who knew the mass evictions of their customers would destroy their businesses, but it was more than businessmen. Among the men and women of East Tremont were the sons and daughters of the revolutionaries who had preached socialism and Zionism in the Pale of Settlement and on the Lower East Side, and some of them hadn't lost their faith in justice. At that time, there were a lot of lefts around here, recalls Saul Janowitz. But mostly, it was Lillian Edelstein who fought. Finding engineers willing to defy Moses, the housewife put them to work drawing maps detailed enough to prove from every engineering standpoint that their route was technically feasible. Then she put them to work obtaining hard figures. Exactly how much more Moses' mile would cost than theirs. When they came up with those figures, Moses' route would require the demolition of 54 apartment houses, 90 one- or two-family homes, and 15 one-story taxpayers housing 60 stores, for a total of 159 separate buildings, condemning and demolishing them would cost more than $10 million more than would be required if the road ran where they wanted it to, even without the cost of relocating 1,530 families and the loss of the real estate taxes, close to $200,000 per year at current rates, from the demolished buildings, income the city would be losing year after year forever. She undertook the harder fight of bringing those maps and figures to the attention of the public and of public officials. The press didn't help much. She took the maps to every daily newspaper in the city. Exactly two, the World Telegram and, of course, the Post, printed them. Only the Post displayed the figures with any prominence. She always found a sympathetic ear at the Post. Joe Kahn and Abel Silver dramatically documented the conditions in Section 3. But no other paper portrayed these conditions in any detail. The three papers that counted most in the city, the Times, the Herald Tribune, and the Daily News, never mentioned them, and gave the whole Cross Bronx Expressway fight scanty and slanted coverage. In attempting to enlist the support of other sections in the fight her own was making, she ran into the selfishness that Ptolemy knew was one of Moses' greatest assets in New York, and that Moses, of course, fostered by releasing details of his projects only one section at a time. The East Tremont section of the Cross Bronx Expressway, Section 2, was the expressway's middle section. The eastern section, Section 3, had already been almost cleared. But there was a western section, Section 1. Another 1,413 families were scheduled to be displaced there for the expressway. But Section 1 might have been in South America, for all the interest it showed in her pleas for support. But she fought anyway. Teaching herself to type, she typed onto stencils and cranked out on the Wise mimeograph machine tens of thousands of handbills, as well as postcards and form letters to public officials. She persuaded the 7 neighborhood movie theaters to show slides advertising the next rally or city hall hearing. "They let us stand outside their lobbies for days with petitions and trying to raise money. We were grateful for that." She organized card parties. Subscription $1. Learning that local radio stations such as WBNX were habitually in need of programs to fill up airtime, she filled up that time with programs whose scripts she wrote herself. It was Lillian Edelstein who arranged the rallies and mass meetings to pressure public officials, who chartered buses to take East Tremont housewives down to City Hall for every official hearing on the expressway. Most difficult of all, it was she who persuaded the housewives to take those buses. The people of East Tremont, who believed as gospel that you can't fight City Hall, had made one trip down to City Hall on the assurance that, if they went, they would win, and their loss had convinced them that the gospel was gospel. Trying to keep up enthusiasm, Lillian Edelstein scheduled weekly meetings at the Y, but found that now, if you got 12 tenants coming every week, you were lucky. As for spending more days traveling down to City Hall and sitting there for hours waiting for the Board of Estimate to get to the Cross Bronx Expressway item, that was torture, she says. If the bus left at 10 o'clock, at 9:30 you had to go around and kick in the doors, Janowitz says. But time after time, she kicked them. In an era in which picket lines in front of City Hall were not yet commonplace, she even managed to have picket lines of middle-aged Jewish housewives marching outside City Hall, carrying signs she lettered herself at night. And after a while, it appeared that Lillian Edelstein's efforts were paying off, for one key public official seemed to be listening. During the committee's earlier interviews with members of the Board of Estimate, Robert F. Wagner, Jr. had appeared receptive. To their argument that motorists' convenience should not be put ahead of people's homes, the plump young Manhattan borough president had responded with a nod that seemed to indicate agreement, saying sincerely, "So they'll get to the Catskills 20 minutes faster." He had left the stormy public hearing early, leaving his two votes that, if added to Joseph's and Holly's, would have killed Moses Root, to be cast by his borough works commissioner and key strategist, Warren Moscow. Although he had voted in favor of Moses Root, Moscow had stated before voting that although Wagner was voting for the first step toward condemnation, he would not vote for the last, authorization for the city actually to take title, until every one of the 1,530 families was properly relocated. Now, running hard for mayor, Wagner had Moscow put that promise in writing in several letters to Etna, and, on August 5th, himself put in writing an even stronger promise. In a letter to Etna signed by Wagner and released to the press, Wagner wrote, "As you know, I have consistently taken the position that I would not vote for the acquisition of the property for the Cross Bronx Expressway. I want to assure you that I will vote against any resolution before the Board of Estimate seeking to authorize acquisition of that property." On October 14th, he made the promise in person, repeating it in essentially the same words, "I will vote against any resolution," to more than 1,000 cheering and applauding East Tremont residents packed into the assembly room at PS 44 for one of Lillian Edelstein's rallies. October 14, 1953, was quite a night for East Tremont. Lazarus Joseph, retiring as comptroller, was present and said movingly that human values were more important than a highway. The Democratic candidate for Joseph's position, the Bronx's own Lawrence Jarosa, agreed. Bertha Schwartz, running not for the council this time but for a municipal court judgeship, moved the audience to cheers and delighted nods by reminding them of Moses' threat to resign, and then slyly adding, "Well, no one is indispensable, you know." When Hawley, Wagner's Liberal Party-backed opponent, vowed his determination to continue the fight to save the homes, both of the two favorites for the mayoralty were firmly on record against Moses' route. "Wagner promised," Katz would recall. "There was nothing vague about that." It was no wonder that Lillian Edelstein was confident. Writing to thank Wagner, she said that the tenants would like him to get together with the engineers who had drawn up the alternate route so he could see it was truly feasible. "Why, certainly," Wagner replied, just as soon as the hubbub of the campaign was over. There seemed little reason to worry about a remark one of Joseph's aides had made to her as he stood beside her listening to the speeches. "Will they love you in December as they do in October?" Wagner may have intended to keep his promise. According to at least one of the aides familiar with his thinking at the time, he did. Meeting with a few Etna representatives shortly after the election, he repeated it, along with his crack about the Catskills. But Wagner was a politician who dealt in realities, and as mayor, he was to have a better look than as borough president at the overall realities governing politics in New York City. No mayor who wanted to continue his political career could buck Robert Moses, and Robert Wagner badly wanted to continue his political career. Just as Moses hadn't bothered bargaining with the new mayor on his inauguration day over the question of reappointment to the City Planning Commission, so Moses didn't bother bargaining with him now. He gave him a direct order. In his memoirs, Moses recalls what happened when Wagner protested that he had promised East Tremont that he would move the expressway. "I said, 'I am sorry, Bob, but you will have to tell them you can't move it. The city is not going to make that decision. The city pays only half the cost of land. It is federal and state money that's involved, and I represent these officials. If you try to move this expressway, you'll never get another nickel from us. You will have to explain that it was all a mistake.'" Wagner was not a man to move quickly. It took him almost a year to come around. But he came around. When, now, Etna asked for the interview he had promised them, he was suddenly evasive. And when, finally, the housewives and storekeepers, awed, were ushered into the mayor's office at City Hall and reminded him of his promise, Wagner, in Katz's words, said he didn't remember saying exactly that, and he turned to someone and asked him to look it up. Recalls Lillian Edelstein, "He tried to tell me Robert Moses knows what he's doing because he's an engineer. We argued, and his aide said, 'Excuse me, Your Honor, he's not an engineer.' He was always the same, friendly, very polite, a good listener. He said he would look into it and let you know." "But," says Katz, "we knew by the time we had left the office that he was not going to be supporting us." Hawley and Joseph, East Tremont's allies, were gone from the Board of Estimate. Hawley's replacement, Abe Stark of Brooklyn, indicated he would go along with whatever Moses and the mayor wanted. Jerosa, of the Bronx Chamber of Commerce, as a public official seemed less dynamic than Jerosa as a businessman. Katz was to write, "As far as the Tenants Committee was concerned, he seemed never to have heard of them." Bertha Schwartz, a municipal court judge now, was no longer active in politics. Lyons would not grant them another audience. They had no one to whom they could turn. Proceedings dragged, however, possibly because Wagner, in his anxiety for election, had made a rare, flat promise, and Joe Kahn persisted in reminding the Post's readers of it, once reprinting prominently the letter stating, "I will vote against any resolution seeking to authorize acquisition of that property." In other stories, conceding that while Wagner had sometimes modified that promise by stating only that he would not vote for acquisition until all tenants had been relocated, so far no tenants had been relocated. Possibly because Wagner, taking even a cursory look at the problem now, could not understand what the tenants could not understand, why the route couldn't be changed. At one hearing before the Board of Estimate, when Moses' man Hotchkiss was answering all questions about the possible route change by saying flatly and arrogantly, "It's impossible," the mayor, with an unusual overtone of irritation in his normally placid tones, demanded curtly, "Why is it impossible?" Hotchkiss replied that Moses felt, "It's just impossible." Wagner did not press the point. Possibly because the state had temporarily run out of highway funds, so that no new contracts could be let, and Wagner therefore had both an excuse to offer the coordinator for not speeding relocation proceedings, as well as an opportunity to allow the exact wording of promises to grow a little vague in the public's mind. A key element was the attitude of the aide the mayor had delegated to deal with the tenants, Deputy Mayor Henry Epstein, a distinguished attorney and older man whom the mayor respected. Epstein, a former Moses ally for philosophical, not financial reasons, now, moved by the tenants' plight, made the mistake of making his own survey of the two proposed routes. There was, he told Wagner, not the slightest rational reason why the expressway could not be moved over two blocks. The City Planning Commission gave the tenants the type of public hearing that might have been expected from a body controlled by a man who, if given his way, would have abolished public hearings. A large delegation had taken the day to ask the commission not to approve the Moses route. A long day. Commission Chairman John H. Bennett, at that moment secretly negotiating a Title I transaction for which he needed that man's approval, refused to let even one tenant speak, saying that no public hearing was required. But there was a whole series of hearings before the Board of Estimate. Sometimes Moses was present himself. "He always looked surprisingly young and vigorous," Katz recalls. "He was very cool and detached. He didn't say anything. He had his assistants do all the talking for him. He sat and listened. He made some notes. My greatest anger at him was that he didn't seem to be affected by all this. People were getting up and telling these stories of hardship." But, despite Moses' presence, the board kept postponing a final vote on his request to have the city authorize condemnation proceedings. After an emotional meeting with the Aetna group and several Bronx councilmen in Wagner's office, at which the mayor was visibly moved, and at which he said, "Every member of the board will want to know the difficulties facing each family in the path of the expressway," the mayor interrupted one board session, at which Moses had confidently expected the issue to be resolved, to order McCullough, who had done a study of the tenant's alternate route for Impellitteri in a matter of minutes, to give it a little more consideration. The engineer returned a month later with a report stating that while the alternate route would spare the protesters' homes, it would require the condemnation of almost as many homes belonging to other people. "You see," Moses told the board, "it was just as he was always trying to explain to them. Changing a route would just trade in one group of protesters for another. No matter where you tried to build a highway in the city, there would be protests, so the only way to handle them was to ignore them." Aetna's leaders, who had been certain that not a single home would have to be touched for the alternate route they had proposed, were shocked by McCullough's findings, until they realized the trick that the engineer had played. He had studied an alternate route all right, but not their alternate route. Instead, he had selected a route that would require large-scale condemnation and studied that instead. Epstein explained this to Wagner.